Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
At Mindy and Joe McNulty's home in Mount Juliet, Tennessee, coronavirus testing supplies are in the kitchen. The parents gather there with their two sons to do home tests in a new study involving American families. The McNultys are among about 2,000 families in 11 U.S. cities taking part in a DIY, or do-it-yourself, study to learn more about the coronavirus. In all, the experiment involves around 6,000 people. The families have no in-person contact with researchers. They get the necessary testing supplies in the mail. This virus is so unknown, any little bit we can do felt like we were doing something to help, Mindy said, explaining why the family chose to take part. The study looks for answers to some of the most difficult questions about COVID-19. How many U.S. children and teens are infected? How many children who are infected show no symptoms? How likely are they to spread it to other children and adults? Dr. Tina Hartert of Vanderbilt University is leading the government-financed study. She recently told the Associated Press that we just don't know yet the degree to which children can transmit the virus. Transmit is a verb that means to cause a virus or disease to be given to others. Evidence from the U.S., China, and Europe shows that children are less likely to become infected with the virus. They are also less likely to become seriously ill when they do get sick. There is also data suggesting that young children do not transmit the virus very often. But the data does suggest that children age 10 and over may spread the virus just as easily as adults. The new study aims to find better evidence. The families collect their own nasal swabs for COVID-19 tests. Less often, they also collect blood and stool samples. The samples are sent off by mail. Subjects receive text messages that ask about possible symptoms and that remind them to test. The study could help give information about the safety of in-class education during the coronavirus crisis. However, results are not expected before the end of the year. The exact number of COVID-19 cases in children remains unclear. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that at least 175,000 cases have been confirmed in those aged 17 and under. Those cases make up less than 10% of all confirmed cases in the U.S. But health experts say the true number is likely much higher because many children do not get tested. The family study is also investigating whether children with asthma or allergies might have some protection against COVID-19. Experts do not know why that might be the case, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The Institute is paying for the research. As a mom, former schoolteacher, and scientist, Hartert wants to better understand the coronavirus. She says it is possible that none of the families will get infected. But that possibility is highly unlikely, given the number of COVID-19 cases across the country, she added. Mindy McNulty says so far her family has remained healthy. She and her husband are both 39 and don't feel too worried about getting sick. She is waiting to see what happens when her children return to school in mid-August. They will go to school 2 days a week, with face coverings and social distancing, and do online learning 3 days a week. I am prepared to bring everyone home if outbreaks occur, she said. McNulty said the boys, 7-year-old Andrew and 9-year-old Hudson, were happy to take part in the study. She helps them do the nose swabbing, and they both say it does not really hurt. Dr. David Kimberlin says he and other health experts have been waiting for the kind of data the family study will provide. Generally speaking, the virus behaves differently in children than adults, said Kimberlin, a professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Why is that? We just need to know so much more. I'm John Russell.
Increasing government attempts to censor or regulate the Internet may result in new digital borders that could change the ways we currently experience the World Wide Web. Authoritarian governments have long operated digital borders to restrict the flow of information and censor material it does not want its citizens to receive. One of the largest such efforts is in China, where the government blocks major parts of the Internet in a massive system known as the Great Firewall of China. But there have also been attempts by countries to create digital borders by enacting rules that limit how the Internet and technology companies can operate in those areas. The justification for such rules in democratic systems usually centers on protecting the individual privacy and national security. The European Union, EU, has been one of the most active legislators in this area. About 2 years ago, the EU approved a massive privacy measure known as the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. It aims to protect the personal data of citizens and requires companies to follow rules relating to how they collect, process, and store such information. The regulations cover not only all EU nations, but also American-based technology companies doing business there, including Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple. In recent years, the EU has launched numerous investigations into U.S. technology companies for violating rules related to privacy protection or antitrust laws. The European Commission, EC, for example, fined Google $2.7 billion in 2017 for unfairly influencing online search results for its own businesses. Then, in 2018, Google was hit with a record $5 billion antitrust fine related to its business operations. Several additional investigations involving technology companies are ongoing in the EU into possible violations of user privacy or antitrust regulations. Justin Sherman is an expert on internet technology and cybersecurity at the Atlantic Council, a research group in Washington. He told VOA that EU regulatory efforts over the years have resulted in changes that have reshaped the internet experience in Europe in some ways compared to the U.S.
Now there's increasing divergence a little bit in how the regulations shape that space.
Sherman added that there are also increasing attempts, many by authoritarian governments, to use technology to block data from getting in.
States are limiting just how easy it is for information to flow across borders.
James Lewis is a senior vice president and director of the Technology Policy Program at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. He told VOA that even though increasing efforts to regulate or block parts of the internet exist, he still sees the internet as the worldwide network it was first set up to be.
The basic information superhighway was based on protocols that still work and they still connect everyone. But a lot of countries have put speed bumps in the highway.
Lewis said that in the beginning, internet regulation was considered unnecessary. But today, there are a lot more public concerns about how people and organizations can misuse it.
It's privacy and security more than anything else that drive a lot of these speed bumps.
Even the man credited with inventing the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, has called for major changes to make the internet better for humanity. Last year, he released A Contract for the Web, designed as a guide for governments, companies, and citizens to take actions in an effort to improve the web. Lewis noted a recent ruling by the EU's top court that found that an existing agreement on transatlantic data flows is no longer acceptable and must be recreated. The agreement, known as the Privacy Shield Framework, covers large data flows between Europe and the U.S. Companies including Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Amazon are affected by the agreement. Lewis predicted it will not be easy for EU and U.S. negotiators to create replacement rules, mainly because of long-standing differences over privacy regulation.
So I think 2021 will be the year of internet regulation, and we can look forward to more of this. It won't break the internet, it'll just make it a lot more complicated to use.
In the U.S., recent threats have come from the Trump administration to ban Chinese apps such as TikTok and WeChat. U.S. officials say the apps could misuse private data and represent a risk to national security. But both Lewis and Sherman say they see such threats as politically driven in a complex U.S.-China relationship. Such bans would be nearly impossible to enforce, they noted. Sherman says it would be more useful for the government to set up better trust vetting processes to identify which apps and technologies present specific privacy and security risks. He also called for the development of strong democratic coalitions to create better internet freedom policies. In the U.S., building more political will can also better equip officials to create stronger digital policies at home, Sherman added.
It is possible, and we should want this, it's possible to both uphold those democratic regulations at home and contest this technological authoritarianism abroad. We can do both.
I'm Brian Lynn.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The year was 1775. Colonists in Massachusetts had fought battles with British troops in the towns of Lexington and Concord. War had not been declared, but citizen soldiers in each of the 13 American colonies were ready to fight. Who was going to organize the colonists into an army? This was the first question that faced the Second Continental Congress when delegates met in May in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The delegates decided that the man for the job was George Washington. He had experience fighting in the French and Indian War. He seemed to know more than any other colonist about being a military commander. The delegates elected him as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He accepted the position, but said he would not take any money for leading the new army. George Washington left Philadelphia for Massachusetts, where he took command on July 3, 1775.
He was tall, he was very elegant, very well put together.
Jane Gorton at the Massachusetts Historical Society says Washington looked very impressive.
It's very interesting because when he came to take command of the Continental Army, many of the New England soldiers were not quite sure what to make of this man who was, after all, from Virginia, not from New England. Washington won them over. His conduct, his grace, I think his discipline was extremely important.
Back in Philadelphia, the delegates to the Second Continental Congress made one more attempt to prevent war with Great Britain. They sent another message to King George. They asked him to consider their problems and try to find a solution. The king would not even read the message. You might wonder, why would the delegates try to prevent war if the people were ready to fight? The answer is that most of the members of the Congress and most of the colonists were not yet ready to break away from England. They continued to believe they could have greater self-government and still be part of the British Empire. Jane Gorton at the Massachusetts Historical Society says many colonists felt conflicted and confused about their identity.
They're Englishmen, they're still Englishmen, but they're not Englishmen. All along, what they've wanted is just to have the rights of Englishmen, and it doesn't seem to be possible under an old system.
A major battle took place in June of 1775, just 2 days after the delegates in Philadelphia chose George Washington as commander. It was the first major battle of the American Revolution. It was called the Battle of Bunker Hill, although it really involved two hills, Bunker and Breeds. Both are just across the Charles River from the city of Boston. Massachusetts soldiers dug positions on Breeds Hill. The British started to attack from across the river. The Americans had very little gunpowder. They were forced to wait until the British had crossed the river and were almost on top of them before they fired their guns. Their commander reportedly told them not to fire on the British until they saw the whites of their eyes. The British climbed the hill. The Americans fired. A second group of British soldiers climbed the hill. The Americans fired again. The third time, the British reached the top, but the Americans were gone. They had left because they had no more gunpowder. Peter Drummy, a librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society, reads part of a letter that a young soldier wrote to his mother.
I was in the fort when the enemy came in, jumped over the wall, and ran half a mile, where balls, that is, musket balls, flew like hailstones and cannon roared like thunder.
The British captured Breed's Hill, but Peter Drummy says the Americans still considered the battle a kind of victory.
The paradox is, even though the American forces are defeated and forced off the hill, nevertheless, the British casualties are so high that it is at least a moral victory.
Even the young American soldier who fled the battle wrote to his mother that he would continue fighting for American independence.
And in fact, that's probably what the British learned from this battle, that they could capture this hill at great cost, but the New England countryside is full of hills, and they couldn't capture them all back.
That battle also reduced whatever hope was left for a negotiated settlement. King George declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. The American colonists fought several battles against British troops in 1775. Yet, the colonists were still not ready to declare war. Then, the following year, the British decided to use Hessian soldiers to fight against the colonists. Hessians were mostly German mercenaries who fought for anyone who paid them. The colonists feared these soldiers and hated the British for using them. In January of 1776, Thomas Paine published a document that strongly influenced the colonists. He named the pamphlet Common Sense. It attacked King George as well as the idea of a monarchy, a government led by a king or queen. The pamphlet called for independence. About 150,000 copies of Common Sense were sold in the colonies. Everyone talked about it. As a result, the Second Continental Congress began to act. It opened American ports to foreign shipping. It urged colonists to establish state governments and to write constitutions. On June 7, 1776, Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee proposed a resolution for independence. The resolution was not approved immediately. Declaring independence was an extremely serious step. Signing such a document would make the delegates traitors to Britain. They would be killed if captured by the British. The delegates wanted the world to understand what they were doing and why. So they appointed a committee to write a document giving the reasons for their actions. One member of this committee was Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. He had already written a report criticizing the monarchy.
so the other committee members asked him to write the new document. They said he was the best writer in the group. They were right. Jefferson was 33 years old. It took him 17 days to write the document. The Second Continental Congress approved it on July 4, 1776. It was America's Declaration of Independence. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University says the Declaration was a message to the world.
They are trying to, I think, signal to the world, we are a new nation, we've broken away from this other nation. We're a separate nation, and we want recognition of our independence.
The Declaration of Independence begins with these words.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
The Declaration goes on to say,
we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government.
The British believed that the Americans were violating British law. Jefferson argued that the British treatment of the American colonies violated the natural laws of God. This idea of natural law had been expressed by British and French philosophers more than 100 years earlier. Jefferson had studied these philosophers in school. But in writing the Declaration of Independence, he said the words came straight from his heart. The Declaration goes on to list 27 complaints against the king. There are complaints against taxes without the consent of the colonists and against the presence of British troops in the colonies. After the list, Jefferson went on to write this statement.
That these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And that as free and independent states, they have the full power to levy war, conduct peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Jefferson concluded the Declaration with a line that was meant to persuade the delegates to support the most serious step, revolution.
And for the support of this declaration, with the firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.